Thank you all for coming out. My name is Blake Sorensen. I am a patent attorney. I'm currently working for a company here in Atlanta called AirWatch. I'm a senior IP counsel for them, where my responsibilities are both drafting their patents and defending against patent lawsuits. This is mostly going to be about the personal audio podcasting patent. I'll go into a fairly heavy bit of detail about that, but I've also got half dozen other recent cases that are shaping patent law for the technical industries, both electronics and biochemistry, that have really shaken things up this year. So we'll touch on all of that. I'm going to go real quickly through a sort of patents 101. I don't know how much or how familiar people are with the system, but typically whenever there's a news story about patents, there's a lot of misinformation, a lot of misunderstanding about the way patents work. So I like to just lay a bit of a foundation. I'll go through the process of how do you get a patent, how do you respond if you're accused of infringing a patent, and then we'll dive into the personal audio patent itself. There are basically four main types of intellectual property. There's copyrights, there's trademarks, there's trade secrets, and there are patents. Copyrights are on creative works, stories, sculptures, architecture, fashion, what have you. Trademarks are your brand, your logo. It identifies the source of a particular object. Trade secrets are what you protect. It's the science behind your product. The Coke formula is the classic example of a trade secret. And then there are patents, which are on a method, a process, a thing, a chemical. It's some tangible improvement to science, some functional improvement to the knowledge of the public. We have patents because in the Constitution from the very beginning, Article 1, Section 8, you can follow along in your little ACLU handbooks if you've got them. The Congress shall have power to promote the progress of science and the useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries. This means that we reward you with a limited monopoly on what you create in order to encourage innovation and creativity. Patents themselves grant a 20-year monopoly from the date that you file them. Before 1995, it was actually 17 years from the date the patent issued. That caused a lot of problems because someone would file something in 1977 and they'd keep it alive in the patent office and no one would know about it, and then they'd get it issued in 1994 and have 17 years from that once they saw what all their competitors were doing. Now, because it's 20 years from the date of filing, it doesn't matter how long it takes you to get the patent, the term is fixed. With the software and electrical arts, that usually doesn't come up because the technology changes so quickly. The personal audio patent is a rare example of an early filed patent that's still very relevant to the technologies that are being used today. And I'll get into that in a bit, but it was filed in 1996. And here we are almost 20 years later, and it's still covering a very lucrative business. There are three main requirements to get a patent. You have to show that your invention is useful, which means it does something, it's functional. You can't get a patent on artwork. You can get a patent on a mechanism for driving a little flea circus Ferris wheel. Entertaining is functional, but it has to actually do something. There has to be some function. It's a very low bar to get over, but there has to be something there. Novel means it's not been done before. There's no single reference out there that shows that someone's done this, and non-obvious means that there's no combination of references that shows that, someone did A and someone else did B. It's obvious to put them together and come up with C. And the example I like to use of that is someone has a highlighter and someone has a retractable ballpoint pen. Well, I make a retractable highlighter. That's obvious. They're two writing instruments. It's obvious to combine those two and come up with the new item. You can't get a patent on that. Patents grant the right to exclude other people from doing what the patent claims. It does not give you any right to make money off of it necessarily. Doesn't give you the right, doesn't help you manufacture it unless you can use it to get funding. It doesn't give you the right to do anything except keep other people from using it. And that's what patent lawsuits are about. They're about suing people to either get a license to continue doing what they're doing or to make them stop because they're a competitor and they're competing with whatever product you happen to be making. Especially with software patents, the first section of the Patent Act, 35 U.S. Code, Section 101, talks about what is actually patentable. And it's very basic, very general. This first quote, whoever invents or discovers any new and useful process, machine, manufacture, or composition of matter, or any new and useful improvement thereof, may obtain a patent, therefore. That's the whole text of Section 101. That's all the Congress has said about what is eligible to get a patent. And we have probably seven cases that I'm going to run through from the past two or three years that have tried to figure out the heck Congress was trying to tell the patent office to let become a patent. The general exception from patent eligibility are what's called laws of nature, natural phenomena, and abstract ideas. I'll talk about that a little bit in a later case with Myriad. They tried to patent a DNA sequence that they had discovered. That is a natural phenomenon. It occurs in nature. They just found it. You can't patent a new insect because you found it. You can't patent lightning because you were the first person to see it. You can't patent mathematical formulas or equations because they're natural phenomena. They're laws of nature. E equals mc squared cannot be patented. If you come up with a new way of violating that law and can build an engine to go faster than light, then that you can patent, but you can't patent the fundamental mathematics behind it. Infringement of patents. There's various types of infringement. Direct is when you are doing exactly what the patent claims. For example, I've got the retractable highlighter example. I am making retractable highlighters. A competitor has a patent on retractable highlighters. They accuse me of direct infringement because I'm selling the same product. Contributory or inducement to infringe is when you encourage others to violate the patent. Someone has, say, a patent on a mechanism for retracting a convertible roof on a car, and you sell the spring part that lets that invention work. You are inducing others to infringe the patent because you are helping them to build or activate that mechanism, so you can be accused of inducement or contributory infringement. Willful infringement comes in primarily when it comes to assessing damages. If you know about the patent and you can be proved to show that you know about the patent, then the patent holder is entitled to triple damages, which are usually based on lost sales or a reasonable royalty for the patent. So you get whatever you would have gotten normally, triple that, and then add on attorney's fees. And the typical attorney's fees for a patent infringement case come out to about $2 million. That's an average. It can go much higher. Typically, with a patent lawsuit, it starts off with a letter. I believe your product X is infringing my patent, you know, 8,122,301, whatever the U.S. patent number is. You need to pay me typically a troll, a non-practicing entity will ask for about $50,000 to $75,000 just to go away, because it's a non-trivial amount of money, but it's a lot cheaper than defending against a patent. So a lot of companies will just pay it to get the license and make it go away. If they don't, then it goes to court. The court decides what the claims in the patent actually mean. The jury then decides whether the claims cover the product at issue, and then damages are assessed by the jury, which the judge basically takes as a recommendation. And then the judge can up or lower those damages as he sees fit, really. There's not a lot of control over that, as long as it's not obviously abusing his discretion, which is the standard of review if it goes to a higher court. And again, the damages are typically if the person asserting the patent is actually making it, they can show how many sales they've lost, how much they charge per unit, what have you, take that price, apply it to their competitor's product, however many they sold times that price. They can get that as damages. If they're not a practicing entity, we do go to a formula what's called reasonable royalty, which is what would a company normally pay to license this part of this technology. And if it's a major part, you know, say, like the axle of a car. Well, the car's not really any good without that. So you're going to get a huge portion of the cost of the car as a reasonable royalty. If you're talking about, you know, the annoying feature in Word when you paste something in and it copies the HTML formatting from that other document that you didn't want anyway, you know, it's a tiny little feature. No one buys Word to get that feature. You're going to get a much, much smaller percentage of the overall cost of the product because it's a tiny part of the product that's being produced. So how do you get a patent? As you're developing, you want to document everything. Research notebooks are your friend. You want to be able to prove that you developed this idea in case someone comes along and tries to accuse you of having stolen it later. Code repositories, backups, anything that's time-stamped is good. Actually, still a lot of pharmaceutical companies have a notary on staff just so that they can stamp each page of the researchers' notebooks at the end of every day. Confidentiality. If you reveal what you're working on before you file the patent, it's too late. You put it in the public domain. So that counts as talking to investors unless you get them to sign a non-disclosure agreement. You want to be sure and keep all of your ideas secret under non-disclosure until you've got that patent filed or you've basically sacrificed your right to get that patent. Again, document everything. Don't publish anything. Open betas are bad and NDAs are good. Yeah, question?
Does it switch from first to first inventor
then file change what you have to do? It does somewhat because previously under the first to invent, you could go back and prove using all this documentary evidence that you had invented it before you filed the patent. Now you can't antedate other references that way under the first to file system, but it can still be useful to prove that you haven't stolen the idea from someone else if that comes up later. There's a new proceeding in the patent office called derivation proceeding, which is basically someone accuses you of having stolen their idea and the patent office decides who actually invented it first and who is not entitled to a patent because of their theft of the idea. Parts of the patent, there's a background section which talks about what's come before and what the problem is. There's the figures. Everything that you claim must be shown in the figures in some way. For software, that's typically a flowchart or a state diagram. For chemicals or drugs, it's a chemical breakdown. For hardware, for a computer, it'll show the chips and the digital circuit layout. For mechanical engines, it'll show the operation of, say, a clutch mechanism for a transmission. But it has to be shown in the figures. It has to be illustrated. Because when you file the patent, you're basically saying, you're making the exchange that for a limited period of time, I get to enforce this. But then my idea is in the public domain, and everyone should be able to duplicate this idea from what's in the patent. It should be a complete set of blueprints and instructions of how to do what I'm claiming. And then the claims are the heart of the patent. That's what you actually look at when you talk about infringement. It's the last section of the patent, and I'll go through the personal audio patent in detail each step of the claim, but it's, you know, a media player for acquiring and reproducing media program files which represent episodes. In a series of episodes, as said episodes become available, said media player comprising memory, communications port, and a processor that does all these steps. And then when you talk about infringing the patent, you must do each and every one of those steps as it's described in the patent, or you're not infringing. Which is why typically the shorter the claim, the easier it is to make an infringement argument. The flip side of that is the shorter the claim, the broader the scope is, and the more likely you might be to find prior art that already does that, or a combination of references that already do that. The more specific you get in the claim, then you've got to find more and more references to show that each of these little details was covered before. How do you defend against a patent? Say you get a letter that says, you're infringing my patent. There are several ways to go about it. The first is you can get an opinion of counsel, which is you go to either your in-house attorney or an attorney at a law firm who looks at the patent, looks at your product, and says, no, you're not infringing, and that's my legal opinion. And he signs it, and then he's on the hook for malpractice if he finds out later that he was wrong, which is why patent attorneys rack up $2 million in bills every time there's a patent lawsuit. You can just license the patent. It might be that they come at you and say, look, I only want $5,000. You're making, you know, $1 million a year on this. It's no big deal. Just license it. It'll be cheaper than paying an attorney to go get an opinion, to take it to court, what have you. If it's a practicing entity, someone who has products of their own, and you've got your own patents, you can counter assert. Say, well, I might be infringing your patent, but you're infringing my patent. And then you can just cross license and say, I'll give you a license to mine if you give me a license to yours. And depending on the value of the patents, there might be some money that changes hands, but it will usually reduce the amounts. You can throw the patent into re-exam, which is a procedure at the U.S. Patent Office. It basically goes back to the examiners at the Patent Office to look at new art that's been found that they may not have found during the initial process of evaluating the application for the patent. There are two types, ex parte and inter partes. Ex parte means only the patent owner talks to the Patent Office. Anyone can file it and throw it into an ex parte re-exam, but once they filed it, they have no more input. They don't get any communication. They don't find out anything that's going on until the Patent Office is done with it. Inter partes is more like a lawsuit. The patent owner and whoever is putting it into re-exam both get to respond to all of the Patent Office's decisions and findings about the patent. So you argue back and forth, you file briefs. It's very much like a mini version of the lawsuit. It can be cheaper than a lawsuit, certainly. You still need to have an attorney to do it, but there's a lot less of the background parts of litigation, of discovery, and all the other stuff that goes along with it. The Patent Office charges $12,000 just to open an ex parte re-exam case. It's $25,000 to open an inter partes re-exam, and that's even if they decide that there's no reason to go ahead with the re-exam afterwards. That's the base fee that you have to throw just to get them to consider it. After that, you still have to pay for each response that you file. There's various charges and fees. And this is why the Patent Office is the only unit of the federal government that shows a profit. Actually, the sequester shouldn't have affected them. That's going on with all the budget fighting, except that every other department in the government is raiding their treasury to find money to operate because they have a positive bank balance. You can file a declaratory judgment, which is where you say, I've been accused of asserting this patent. I want the court to say, no, you're not. It's basically, it's still a lawsuit, but instead of the person asserting the patent filing the lawsuit, the person being accused of infringement files it. And it has the advantage that you get to pick where you want to file the suit. So if you're an Atlanta company, it might be much more convenient for you to file here in the federal courts in Atlanta rather than wait to be sued in Texas or California or wherever. Way to deal with competitors, make sure you do a search on what their patents are and consider cross-licensing. Suppliers, you can always get indemnification from those. I won't go into much of that. Here we go. The patent assertion entities are patent trolls. This is where we start getting into the real meat of the current disputes. The red section there are the number of patent cases filed by trolls over the last few years. And as you can see, it's getting to be more and more of a popular hobby for a lot of attorneys. There are some ways that are trying to address the rise of these patent assertions. President Obama recently signed several executive orders that directed the Patent Office to offer advanced training for the examiners, especially as it regards software patents. It ordered the Patent Office to do more outreach and more training of small companies and individual inventors. They're basically producing extra pamphlets and documents for anyone who wants to download them from the website that explains what to do if you get sued by a troll and what your options are. And they've started a real party in interest requirement. This means that if the patent is actually assigned to, say, HP or IBM, but there's some, you know, three guys and a dog LLC accuses you of infringing the patent, they still have to say who owns the patent and who the real party in interest, who's going to get the money out of this suit is going to be. So you can't hide behind a shell company anymore. There are several legislative proposals to deal with it. The two big ones that would probably do the most to help are shielding individuals for off-the-shelf uses. If I go to Best Buy and I buy a Netgear router, and then I get sued because I'm infringing a patent on some routing protocol, I mean, what am I going to do as an individual? I don't have $50,000 to license a $50 router, but you might get asked to do that. So there's a proposal currently floating around the Senate to make it so that anyone who buys a commodity product is shielded from an assertion of patent. You have to go after the manufacturer rather than the end user. And the other one is to change the standard for award of attorney's fees to a loser pays system. If you accuse someone of infringing an overbroad patent and it's found invalid, you have to pay the other person's attorney's fees to defeat that patent. So, here we go. The personal audio pod. Patent. It's recently been targeted by the EFF patent busting project. I spoke to a couple of the guys at EFF. They have gathered a bunch of prior art. They're just about to kick off an inter-parties re-exam against this patent to try and get it ruled invalid. They've had a lot of success in the past. They've got some very good pro bono attorneys over there. According to the EFF press release, claiming it owns the patent that broadly covers podcasting technology, personal audio is the classic example of a patent troll that neither makes nor sells anything, but uses its patent as a weapon to threaten lawsuits and extort settlement fees. And that is the typical behavior of a patent troll. They want to come in, they want to get a quick license, they don't really want to go to court, because that's expensive for them too. But they do want to get some money off of whatever patent they happen to have filed or acquired or licensed, however they've gotten hold of it. But so far, this patent's doing pretty well. They sued Apple and won. It wasn't a settlement. They actually won at trial. They got a jury award of $8 million. That's on appeal right now, but Apple threw a lot of prior art at it. They tried to invalidate it. And they failed. So it's held up to at least one major challenge. We'll see how the EFF does when they throw it back into the PTO. One of the problems that the PTO is going to have is now that all the prior art that Apple threw against the patent and was found not to render it obvious or anticipate it, make it non-novel, the patent is presumed to have overcome that, so you can't throw that. Well, you can throw it into the inter-parties re-exam, but the patent office isn't going to consider it because it's already been considered by a court. They'll say that, well, obviously this patent is not obvious over this other prior art because it's already been decided by a judge and jury. But they weren't good with just settling for Apple. They started targeting individuals and small companies who are, you know, doing podcasts out of their home studio. They're going after just about everyone now who has got any kind of sizable subscriber base because they feel that they've got a strong patent. It's been validated once in court. They're even going after the higher profile podcasters like Adam Carolla and the How Stuff Works podcast. The claims themselves, and we'll go into that in a minute, are actually directed to downloading episodes. So they could go after the individual subscribers as well. This is that same thing I was talking about with the legislative proposal. We want to shield the end user just for purchasing or even downloading for free an episode off of the App Store or whatever. They're technically in violation of this patent, so personal audio could sue them. The assertion letters that they're sending out don't name a price or demand a payment yet. They're like, we notice you have a podcast. Did you know we have a patent on that? Let's set up a time to talk. And that's typically how they do this. They want to get an idea of how many subscribers you have. Are you making any money? Do you have advertisers? And then they'll begin a conversation to establish a fair licensing fee. Well, a lot of people don't want to pay a licensing fee to do something as a hobby, so they're just stopping. Yeah, question.
Talking about licensing fees specifically, do we have any examples that have been made public of what those numbers are for specific categories by listenership?
We don't, because all of the licensing agreements are confidential. And that's one of the things that they are insisting on when you sign a license with them, is that you may not disclose the terms of the license. Although some of that will could come out in the FF case. They could ask for that as part of the process of going through this reexamination. The recipients obviously call it extortion, which it arguably is. There is a threat of expensive litigation if you don't pay the licensing fee. Jim Logan, who is the owner of this patent, he's the inventor on this patent. He is the CEO of Personal Audio. He says, the whole purpose of the patent system is to get people thinking and to conjure up ideas. While the White House says that patent trolls stifle innovation and put a drag on our economy. Obviously, there's a fair bit of agreement with the White House on this point, because when EFF tried to raise the $30,000 to put it into re-exam, they hit that in 10 hours and doubled it by the end of the day.
Is this going to affect video blogging?
Yes. It is not specific. The claims are not specific to audio. It is, and I'll go through that in a second, but it is all about downloading serial episodes of multimedia or media files.
That's a lot of channels on YouTube.
Yes, it is. Another question.
I'm one of the people who do it as a hobby. I mean, I've never made a dime. I pay money to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I know, no one has my actual physical address. What should I be looking for to make sure they're not targeting me and I just don't realize it? Would it come through my email?
They to get this process started, they would need to send you a certified letter.
Okay.
Now, they could go to Apple and say, get a subpoena and get the records of who is posting podcasts to the iTunes store and then use that. As far as I know, they have not done that yet. They're really trying to go after more higher profile targets than the people just doing it as a hobby, like the Adam Carollas and the How Stuff Works and NPR's, I forget the name, but NPR's Daily News podcast. They're going after people that they can easily track down and find and who they know are going to be able to actually pay them some money. In theory, you can always sue someone for anything. Welcome to America. But in reality, it's not worth going after individuals usually. They're much more likely to say, to start imposing on Apple, say, a cost of 25 cents for every episode that's uploaded to the iTunes store, at which point Apple might start passing that along to the end user. And now I'm going to go to Mr. Logan's defense, because I'm a lawyer, I can argue both sides of everything. Okay, well, one more question.
So this talk is being recorded and posted online in mm-hmm. a series of audio things from this track, and
mm-hmm.
EFF has money and Dragon Con has money.
Mm-hmm.
Have you made any attempt to license this technology?
None whatsoever. In fact, I am theoretically, and actually I won't say it because we're being recorded. I will refer you back to my earlier slide on contributory infringement, and you can think about what that means. It'd probably be a conflict of interest at that point. Yes, by the way, yes, I'm a lawyer. Nothing I say should be considered legal advice to any of you. I am not your lawyer. We have no attorney-client relationship, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, coming back to Mr. Logan, Jim Logan, the inventor of the podcast. He filed this patent in 1996. This is well before people were really thinking about podcasts. So you can honestly give him some credit for thinking ahead and having some really good ideas back when people were first really starting to use the internet and the web to distribute content. He didn't just come up with this yesterday and decide to start trying to sue people because no one else had filed a patent on it yet. He really has been thinking about this for a long time. And he spent $2 million of his own money trying to manufacture a product and bring it to market. He was a really crappy businessman, and he made some bad deals. And, I mean, you could argue he was ahead of his time. People didn't understand what a podcast was. They didn't get the appeal of having a device that could download audio or video episodes that they could carry around with them. So just because he was a bad businessman and he failed to make a product doesn't mean he didn't have a good idea well before anyone else had come up with it. Apple has obviously taken the idea of podcasting and run with it, and they've done very well with it. So in his defense, this is sort of the idea of what the patent office or what the patent system is supposed to be about. It's supposed to be about the guy who has a great idea who may not have the capital to pull it off, licensing it to people who can pull it off and make it a market success. That's how we reward people for coming up with new ideas. So, the personal audio patent is titled System for Disseminating Media Content, Representing Episodes in a Serialized Sequence. There are 35 claims. As I mentioned before, the claims are the heart of the patent. That's what you have to look at to determine if someone is infringing it. And we'll just look at claim one here. So claim one is a media player for acquiring and reproducing media program files which represent episodes. This is what's the preamble of the claim. This defines what the claim applies to. In this case, it is a media player. Media player is defined in the patent as a hardware device. So it is essentially an iPod, any kind of device that can do all these steps, download these episodes and play them back. The claim goes on, a digital memory with a communications port coupled to the internet, transmitting data, identified by specified URLs, and for storing said downloaded data. Now this is where we start to attack the patent if we want to determine that we're not infringing. Communications port is not specifically defined in the patent. So if it were ever to go to trial, a judge would look at that, he'd look at the specification, he'd look at what that commonly meant in 1996 and decide what a communications port was. They describe it in here as a modem. But typically in patent law, if you've got a concrete example of the way something works at the time it's filed, and there's an obvious technical extension of that, say to an Ethernet card, the patent claim will be read on that unless it's specifically written to exclude other devices. So if this said a modem coupled to the internet, you'd have a much stronger argument that an Ethernet port is not a modem. But a communications port, you can argue, is. But it has to be identified by a specific URL. Well, what if you distribute episodes that are identified in some other way? If you don't give a URL for the episode, then you're not infringing the patent. Say you give a unique identifier, and the device itself is hard-coded to go to a specific server with an IP address. You haven't given it a URL to that episode. You've just given it an identifier. So you could get around the patent that way. Then the communications port, transmitting, receiving, and storing said downloaded data in said digital memory. It doesn't say the processor does the storing, it says the communications port does the storing. So you look at this and you say, well, the Ethernet just passes it up into RAM and then the processor stores it somewhere. You could obviously argue that, well, unless the communications port is directly storing it into the buffer from which it's played back, you're not infringing the patent. And the processor coupled to the digital memory for performing a sequence of timed update operations. The operations comprising downloading via the internet. Well, if you're on a private LAN, no problem. You're not infringing the patent. The current version of a compilation file. Compilation file, that's another fun term. We have to look at the specification to figure out what that means. And it is defined in the specification as a file that contains a series of URLs identifying a sequence of distinct episodes. So you go and you might be able to find some way around that by changing the way that you distribute notification of your new episodes. It might be that your media player device only goes to retrieve an episode when it receives a text message that there's a new episode available. It doesn't do this step of downloading a compilation file to see if there are any new episodes available. So there are always ways around these claims, but this is the way that Apple does it. They put a compilation file on the podcast server that has a list of the episodes and what the link is to download those episodes. So this current version of the compilation file contains attribute data describing one or more episodes. with the episode URLs identifying the media files that correspond to the episodes. And here's what I was talking about. This could be audio, this could be video. It's any kind of media file. There's no specification of that limitation in the claim. Then we process the current version of the compilation file to identify that attribute data, describing one or more newly available episodes which were not described by attribute data found in a prior version of said compilation file. So this doesn't apply to the first time you download a podcast list. It has a list of all the episodes. There's not a previous version of the file to compare it to. So if you create a new podcast every time that just happens to have one more episode in it, but it's a different compilation file, it's not associated with the previous compilation file, you can get around this patent. Now, that's obviously a pain in the butt. You want people to be able to use that subscribe link in iTunes so that they get the notification of each new episode. You don't want them to have to come and get each new episode as a different podcast every time. And then downloading the new media files. Well, if your process just downloads the compilation file and lets you know that there's a new episode available, and then you have to go via a separate device and download the podcast, again, you're not infringing the patent. But again, this is the way iTunes does it. You auto-subscribe, it auto-downloads the new episode every time it finds a new one. And then an output unit for reproducing one or more of the media files representing episodes in said series. So if you had a USB stick that didn't have an audio output, it just connected to the podcast server, downloaded the podcast, and then you had to plug it into another device that would play it back, you'd avoid the patent. But again, that's not how Apple does it, which is why they wind up paying millions of dollars. Are there any questions about that patent before? Yeah.
Hold on a second.
Can you go back to the previous
slide? Yeah.
Okay. So are they saying that, because like in iTunes, I usually download a podcast to my computer and mm-hmm. then transfer it via cable to my iPod. So in that case, in your opinion, is that a non-infringing event?
No, because it doesn't require the file to actually be played back. It just requires that the device you download it to have an output unit that could play it back.
Okay. So a computer would count in this case as mm-hmm. the hardware device.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks.
Another question?
Based on what you're saying about his potential legitimate claim here, from my layman's point of view, it sounds like the earlier discussion of patent trolls is almost a red herring, in that this is not a guy who just went out and bought a patent and then started suing people. He actually filed a claim, and it looks like a legitimate argue over whether his claim applies to the current world or not.
It sounds absolutely.
Like he's legitimately attempting to defend something that he thought he filed fair and square, as opposed to a firm that just hires four guys, puts out some money, buys patents, and starts suing people, which is really trolling.
Yeah, okay. I agree with that. And we should probably call him the nicer term of non-practicing entity. Because he does not produce a product. He doesn't actually sell a product now. He tried and failed. Now he's just trying to license the patent. But yeah, that is an atypical behavior for a non-practicing entity. Moving on to some of the other recent patent cases. Bilski versus Kappos. This came out in 2010, and it was the first time the Supreme Court ever considered software patents. This patent concerned the claims to processes for participants in an energy commodities market to hedge against the risk of price changes in those commodities. It was basically a market tracker that watched the price of a certain commodities, corn or oil or whatever, and made sure that your deal closed before the price changed too much. You had this series of steps and made sure that you had a counter risk position, which means you had an option to buy at the new price if you needed it to make sure you didn't lose money on the deal. However, the Supreme Court held that these claims failed to recite patent-eligible process under Section 101 because they covered the abstract idea of hedging against risk. And it's hard to argue that people haven't been hedging against risk since the beginning of commerce. Allowing the claims would preempt use of this approach in all fields and would effectively grant monopoly over an abstract idea. And this idea of preemption is one that comes up again and again when we're considering patent-eligible claims. If what you're doing is going to preempt anyone from doing anything in this field because you're trying to patent a mathematical formula, you know, you can't patent the method of calculating the volume of the sphere because it's a natural phenomenon. It's a natural phenomenon. It's not an abstract idea. But you can't stop people from doing that because you can't monopolize math. And that's been the Supreme Court's position. They've been taking very slow steps towards trying to reconcile this process where a lot of people are doing what's called business method patents, which are where you're using a computer to do something that's typically been done by the human brain. And just the fact that the computer can do it much faster doesn't make it a novel idea. A more recent case was CLS Bank that just came out, I want to say in March of this year, maybe April. This was such a big deal. The Federal Circuit, which is the Court of Appeals just below the Supreme Court, actually invited the public to comment on these major questions because they were hoping we could finally have a really decisive case on software patents and come up with a good test and how do we decide this. So how do we determine whether a computer implemented invention is eligible for patenting? When does the presence of a computer lead to patent eligibility for an otherwise unpatentable idea? And whether different types of patent claims should be treated differently when evaluating patent eligibility? Do we use different standards if we're talking about an actual mechanical device versus a computer-implemented process versus a chemical reaction? The claims in this case were directed, much like Bilski, to systems that helped lessen the settlement risk of trades of financial instruments using a computer system. The claims were held invalid. In this case, it was all about essentially using a third-party escrow service to make sure that both parties had the money to conclude a deal before one person paid and found out that the other person couldn't deliver. The test used by the divided circuit was whether the balance of the claim adds significantly more to the foundational abstract idea. In this case, they found that adding a computer instead of using a person to hold both amounts of money, or the money and the product, and then hand them over, was not adding more to the foundational abstract idea. Unfortunately, in a 135-page ruling, 7 of the 10 judges wrote different opinions and each had their own idea of what the proper test was. Gave us no precedential holdings on any of the legal issues involved except that the claims are invalid. We're back to the standard of obscenity. I don't know why, but I know this is invalid when I see it. No opinion, test, or theory garnered a majority of the 10 judges, leaving all these questions unanswered and resulting in a petition to the Supreme Court to tell us what the hell is going on. We had a question over here.
Do you know what circuit that's from?
That's the Federal Circuit, Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit.
No,
the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit hears from all of the districts. So, like, Georgia's the 11th Circuit. Any patent case, however, or copyright case, any federal question like that, goes to the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals. Another one that came out this year is Ultramershal versus Hulu. This was about the advertising and sale of digital media. It was specifically about using multiple, taking a single piece of media and translating it into different formats for distribution to different devices and playback mediums. So it would have an advertisement that had the same basic media, but if it was played back on a computer, it would, say, have a different resolution or different compression. If it was played back on a mobile device, it would change it around some with the special zoom-in effects so that you could see the important parts of the ad on a much smaller screen. And in this case, they said that This invention involved a fair amount of extensive computer interface modifications and changes to the underlying data that was more than just simply adding a computer would accomplish. The computer actually had to do some very specific things to make these claims work. And so those claims were held valid. This case is also pending before the Supreme Court. They've asked for the Supreme Court to hear it. And the question that they're asking, much like in the CLS case, is when a patent's reference to a computer or a computer-implemented service like the internet is sufficient to make an abstract concept patent eligible. Given our history with the Supreme Court and software patents, they'll probably take it up and tell us nothing. The only good thing about this is, as a patent attorney who works on software patents, I've got so much job security right now. another case from this year was Function Media versus Google and Yahoo. This was three patents that were about, much like the Hulu ultra-mercial case, this was about facilitating advertising on multiple advertising outlets. But because the claims had a means for transmitting said presentations that was not defined in the specification of the patent, the claims were invalid for indefiniteness, which means that someone, even a person skilled in the art, would not be able to understand how you would transmit presentations over a network because the spec didn't tell them. It doesn't matter how common that is, because they didn't specify the algorithm in the patent. They didn't say using the MPEG-4 codec over an Ethernet network. That would have saved this patent. But they didn't have that specificity in there. And so the court ruled it was invalid for indefiniteness. So we're starting to see the Federal Circuit trying to tighten up on software patents, make sure that they're adhering to the letter of the law. And the general consensus on this is this is the Federal Circuit slapping a patent troll down. In most cases, if this had been a practicing entity, if this had been Google versus Yahoo, this claim would not have been struck down on indefiniteness. They would have gone to more details. But this was a case where they were looking for an excuse to kick this case out and slap the patent troll down. Moving away from software patents, we have molecular pathology versus Myriad Genetics. And I'm going to go a little bit into the science behind it because it helps understand what the court ruled. A gene sequence has two basic parts, exons and introns. The exons are the part of the DNA that actually does something. They specify the type of amino acids that are produced. Introns are all the junk in between the exons that don't really have any function. Gene refers to a naturally occurring DNA segment that has both the introns and the exons. cDNA refers to a short form of the gene without the introns. Basically, it's a man-made sequence. They found what the sequence is in the DNA, and they've just put those proteins together in the lab. Isolating a gene from the genome does not change its naturally occurring sequence, so it's not patentable. It's a natural phenomenon. But creating cDNA, because you are building that sequence without the introns, you're creating something that does not exist in nature. And so, Myriad filed all these patents based on the fact that mutations in a couple of chromosomes, BRCA1 is on chromosome 10 and BRCA2 is on chromosome 13, if we have any biology geeks, these mutations substantially increase the chance of breast cancer. And the patents that they filed were on the sequences of DNA, on the sequences of cDNA that they isolated, and on the genes themselves, methods for detecting and screening these mutations, and methods for screening anti-cancer drugs in cells containing the mutated genes. So basically, tests for new cancer drugs. The district court invalidated the DNA claims as natural phenomenon, but said that, the district court invalidated all of the claims. The Federal Circuit reversed and held that all the types were patentable, and then the Supreme Court split the difference and said that gene sequences, the naturally occurring DNA, are not patentable, but cDNA sequences are. So when you hear that they're going to start patenting genes, that is true to an extent. They can't patent the genome itself. They can't patent a person's genetic code, but they can isolate particular sequences and create them in the lab. And if those sequences are different from what occurs in nature, then those are patentable. This is causing some worry because a lot of organisms, especially bacteria, don't have introns. So all they have are the exon sequences in the DNA. And there's a lot of question about whether if we isolate a DNA sequence from a bacteria, it doesn't have the introns that are removed when you create the cDNA. So how do you patent that idea, or can you? And that's a question that's been unanswered as far as. And then Monsanto, everyone's favorite company. Soybean farmers in the U.S. use seed that's genetically modified. Monsanto produces about 90% of the soybean seeds in the United States and a significant amount around the world. They've gotten a lot of bad press about this. In their defense, because I can defend anyone, I'm a lawyer, they have increased yields significantly, 5 or 6 times over what would normally be available. They've made it much easier to control pesticides and weeds, or to control pests and weeds, because the crops are now pesticide and herbicide resistant. Whether or not you want to eat GMO food is a personal decision. I've heard both arguments. I don't particularly care. I'll eat it anyway, as long as it tastes good. That's my point. That's all I want. But the seed is 3 times more expensive than the regular unpatented seed. So when you buy it from Monsanto, you actually have to sign an end-user license agreement to use this seed. It says you will not replant the seeds that are produced by your crop this year. Well, this farmer, Bowman, went to his grain elevator where the harvested soybeans are dropped off for delivery to market, and he bought and planted some of those because he knew that they would be Roundup resistant. He didn't sign the license agreement. But this put two legal doctrines in conflict. Patent exhaustion says that once you buy a product, you can do with it whatever you want. You can sell it, you can give it away, you've paid the patent license. But the second patent doctrine says you are forbidden to copy the device. Once you buy an iPhone, you can do whatever you want with it, but you can't make another one and sell it. The Supreme Court unanimously decided that Bowman was an illegal copying of a patented product. Farming piracy, and that's a quote. Bowman can purchase the grain elevator beans to eat or to feed to livestock or even to resell, but he could not copy them by planting them and causing the seeds to grow a new plant. The justices rejected the argument that since soybeans are naturally self-replicating, I didn't do anything, I just threw them out in the field and soybeans grew. Who knew? That made the it was not Bowman's fault that they replicated. But Kagan said, the blame of the bean defense is tough to credit. Bowman was not a passive observer of his soybeans multiplication. However, he produced 8 separate crop yields using the grain elevator beans to maximize regeneration of the beans. So, as it stands, Monsanto wins. They can keep people from reusing their soybean seeds, and they can sue you if, say, your neighbor's soybean pollen flies into your field and creates new strains of Roundup Ready plants. Because, well, the blame the bean defense doesn't work. You're stealing their intellectual property by allowing your neighbor's field to pollinate your own. And yes, it's sad, but that has won. So that was all the cases I had. We've got about 5 minutes left, so if there are any questions about any of these cases or anything on patents in general, I'll be happy to take them.
Let's talk about the practical application. I'm a podcaster. The letter shows up in my mailbox.
Mm-hmm.
Can you recommend steps 1 through 3, what I need to do?
It depends to some extent what the letter says. Typically what they say is we just want to start a conversation. We want to talk about what what possible license might be appropriate. You can go to a lawyer. It's going to be expensive. You need to basically sit down and figure out, are you making any money off of it? If not, the answer is probably to just write them back and say, I don't know what you want from me because my net revenue from this is negative $300 a year. yeah. that would be the way I would approach it as an individual. And see where it goes from there. Because chances are they're not going to go after people. They're not going to spend money on their lawyer's time if they're not going to get any kind of return out of it. They might come back and say, well, then you should just give us $150 for the license or something, and we'll leave you alone. At that point, I can't give legal advice, obviously, but you could suck it up and pay it, or you could just wait for them to sue you because it's going to cost them, you know, $30,000 just to start the suit. and chances are they're not going to come after you for that. I'm going to repeat it. This is not legal advice. If you actually do get this letter, I highly recommend you consult your own attorney. I do not want to be sued for malpractice because I told you to ignore it. any other questions?
You can modify a patent after it's been filed.
Yes, you can amend the patent after it's been filed as long as you don't introduce new material. So, I mean, he's got seven figures and 45 columns of specification in here. He can write claims off of any of these ideas. And in fact, this patent family has five different claim sets written off the same specification already, and he's got others pending. So as long as you had the idea on paper and filed, you can write claims to those ideas far down the road. Now this priority expires in 2016, so if he's going to do anything, he's got to do it soon, which is why he's suing everyone now, because he's only got a few years left, but he could still theoretically issue other patents on the same specification as long as he doesn't add new ideas to it.
So in theory, if you had a podcast or your a blog, all you do is wait until 2016 and then start again.
No. He couldn't get future damages at that point, but the statute of limitations is 6 years. So he could still go back 6 years from 2016. So if you'd been doing it any time between 2010 and 2016, he could come after you.
I just have a general question about how the judges in the patent law system.
Mm-hmm.
I was at the Six Strikes panel yesterday, mm-hmm. and they were talking about the judges aren't necessarily, aren't necessarily knowledgeable about the technologies.
Mm-hmm.
Is that different coming in? I mean, it's the same, it's probably the same judges at some point, like when you get up higher, but mm-hmm. in the lower courts, do you see that, or are the judges that see a lot of patent cases generally more knowledgeable, especially about, you know, software and technology and that kind of thing?
Oh no, that's a great question. Typically, when it's filed at the district court level, so like Northern District of Georgia, you'd file the case there, and all the judges would go, oh God, another patent case, because it takes forever, and there's a lot of complications that goes along with it. Most of them hate patent cases, but there's usually one or two judges who specialize in patent cases, and they'll trade amongst themselves to give the patent case to that particular judge. So some expertise does build up. At the appeals court level, the federal circuit, they specialize in military law, in copyright, and in patent law, the big federal areas of dispute. So they're much more knowledgeable about patent cases. They see lots of them all the time. And then the Supreme Court obviously hears everything. There's a lot of, at the district court level especially, there's usually a tutorial session, which is a few days where the lawyers for each side come in and brief the judge on the technology. and then they go through and they start talking about the claims and what do the claim terms mean. So the judge has to be open to learning about it, but the attorneys have a vested interest in making sure that he understands, he or she understands the technology.
What?
Yeah.
Oh. No, to that, do you recall Scalia's comment before he spoke on his opinion on the bioengineering case?
I don't, not offhand.
Oh, not offhand, Scalia?
No, but that was one of the most troubling things for me in the law is prior to his making his remarks on his opinion, he said, "I don't understand the science, but," mm-hmm. and I mean, when you're talking about bioengineering and genetics, you're going, mm-hmm. Supreme Court, and he's actually, you said that, really? You said that out loud, but of course it is Scalia. So, I mean, Where do you as a patent attorney go from there if you know that on the trail that you're walking, you may be a stranger to these people that are making life and death decisions for your cases?
I would approach it the way I would any other case when I was briefing before a judge. I would make my start with the foundation. You know, obviously this presentation was a very quick and dirty version of the differences between DNA gene sequences and cDNA, but I'll spend 4 hours briefing a judge on, okay, and this is why it's different, and this is all the scientific literature from all the accredited journals that describes the differences, and this is how the experts in the field describe it. And so you may not be able to make them truly understand it, but you should be able to at least convey a basic idea of what the difference is between, say, what's claimed in the patent and what your product is. Okay. All right. Any other questions? Uh-oh.
Just a clarification about the podcast. When you said it wasn't just audio, it was also video. What about a print-based digital subscription? You know, if you subscribe to an online magazine or something, is he going to go after that as well?
Yeah, it would also cover that. It's the claims are written broadly enough to cover any media distributed by networks.
Does that mean the New York Times has to worry about its website?
Yes. Actually, not their website, but their online digital subscriptions, the ones that are delivered directly to the tablets. The website itself doesn't follow under this scope because it's not, you're not downloading an episode list for each one. You're just seeing the changes as they come up on the web page. But for the daily issue that comes out, that is pretty much how they distribute it.
A little bit of a rabbit hole, but in your opinion, do you think this may have contributed to Google sunsetting their RSS reader? Try and get out of the way?
No. From what I understand, the reason that died was because they couldn't find anyone who really wanted to run it. It wasn't really a worry about lawsuit threats on that one. It was a product that had no real commercial value, and so no one at the company wanted to take it over.
Isn't the patent null if you can show that it's common knowledge on how to do these systems, because they're really not that complicated to set up?
It is if you can show it was common knowledge at the time it was filed, and that's really tough to prove that someone knew about podcasting in 1996.
Isn't it the method in which that it's distributed rather than the act of podcasting itself?
It is the act of distribution and downloading the file. Yeah.
Yeah, that was roughly 2 years after they went commercial, so that was all new stuff then.
Yep.
You made the comment earlier that this behavior is atypical of a non-performing entity. From an historical perspective, does that have any influence on the validity or perceived validity of the claim?
None whatsoever.
Okay.
The validity of the claim is based solely on what prior art can be dug up. It doesn't. There are actions and behaviors that can invalidate a patent by the patent holder, but it's typically requires proof that you lied to the patent office or that you've engaged in unfair competition to uncover what your competitors were doing so that you could write the patent claims around it. Basically, if you can show that you stole trade secrets to write the patent, that's the sort of behavior that will invalidate a patent. But going after people for a license, openly, and what I mean, you can call it under pressure or an extortionist behavior, but they're not doing it illegally. And if you're not behaving illegally or against the codes and the rules of the patent office, then the patent office isn't going to consider that behavior. All right. Well, I think we're at time, so thank you all for coming out. And if you've got any more questions, I'll be here.